difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie that we've podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Scott Tobias
and Tasha Robinson.
Once again, we are joined by Allison Wilmore, while our regular co-host Genevieve Kosky blazes a bloody trail through Japan and Europe. Allison, thanks for stepping in.
I just want to warn you, everyone around me, you know, everyone I come in contact with dies.
that's a good warning to have. It's a big warning to throw at us at the top of our second segment together. You couldn't have brought that up earlier.
I just, it's hard to maintain friendships when that's just a truth about you. So sometimes I like to hold on to it for a while just to get some socialization in.
Well, we got to complete this episode at least for our listeners' sake. We got to deliver what we promised.
I don't know.
Which is a John Wick 4 pairing.
I'm feeling a little die-y right now. If you'll excuse me, I'm going to go monologue a lot about a past relationship and then succumb quietly in my bed.
Oh, anyway, last week we discussed Point Blank, the film to which Tasha is alluding. It's a classic revenge movie starring Lee Marvin and directed by John Borman. Years ago, director Jim Jarmusch formed a not-so-secret society called the Sons of Lee Marvin, whose only membership requirement was that its members bear a physical resemblance to the actor. Keanu Reeves looks nothing like Marvin, but for our purposes, we're going to treat Reeves and John Wick Chapter 4 as kind of spiritual heirs to Lee Marvin and Point Blank. Like Point Blank, the John Wick films in general are the stories of a skilled killer working his way to the top of an underworld organization on a mission of revenge. But across those four entries of the John Wick mythology, Wickthology maybe, has expanded, and Wick's body count has mounted in response. Chapter 4 finds Wick trying to settle things with the High Table, a kind of global crime boss council of elders, but he quickly discovers taking out the organization's top member only deepens his troubles. As a bounty placed on his head by the cruel preening Marquis Vincent de Grammont, played by Bill Skarsgård, grows, Wick's antagonists multiply to include Kane, played by Donnie Yen, a blind assassin Wick considers a friend, and Mr. Nobody, played by Shamir Anderson, a confident hitman who's happy to drive at the price before taking Wick out. Will Wick prevail? We already know the answer, and we'll talk it over after the break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Saying goodbyes?
Saying hello.
You think your wife can hear you?
No.
Then why bother?
Maybe I'm wrong.
You're going to die.
Maybe not.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend.
A new day is dawning. New ideas. No rules, no management.
We've known each other since we were 9 or 10.
Who is this?
The Marquis de Grammont.
Challenge him to single combat. Win or lose, it's a way out. I don't sit at the table.
Your family does.
Please pray for me. I was the black sheep of the family.
Man has to look his best when it's time to get married or buried.
I'm going to need a gun.
All right, John Wick Chapter 4. I was looking forward to / dreading this film based on its running time because it is very, very long. But I had a blast. What about everybody else?
I had a good time. I did find it bloated. Like, it felt too long for me at parts. And there are times where I feel like the least interesting parts of these movies are when he is just killing a bunch of henchmen the same way, which felt like it happened more this time around. A lot of the kind of like grappling and then headshots to a bunch of kind of anonymous dudes where I'm like, I want him to kill people I know.
This is too impersonal.
That's, yeah, exactly. I want meaningful, personalized violence. But that said, it's so enjoyable. It's so just committed to be decadent and entertaining. And it had an unexpected and incredible pratfall towards the end that was my favorite part of the movie. So I definitely had a good time.
I'm with you on some of that. The part about finding it really tedious when he kills a whole bunch of dudes in the exact same way. I definitely could have done with a good half an hour to 45 minutes less of this movie. I remember the impact that the style of the first John Wick movie had when so much of its world was a mystery and a really compelling mystery. And as these movies have slathered on like the detail and the incident and have kind of tried to rev up in scale and scope and bring in all the stuff, I find them more interesting when nobody's fighting. You know, the big sequence towards the end that's kind of the final conflict is maybe the most interesting thing in the movie, as far as I'm concerned. Whereas the fight where he's swarmed by about 800 people who are all wearing completely face covering masks, and there's literally nothing to tell them apart except how big or heavy their particular weapon is. And he has to like just work his way through, you know, 1,000 anonymous dudes. And very little of it. There's always a moment where he picks up a new weapon and the whole audience goes, ooh, and kind of giggles because they know they're going to see something new. And then you see him kill like 50 people with that weapon and suddenly it's not as much fun anymore. And I just, there were times during this movie where I was just like, okay, he's been hit by a car 3 times in this scene alone and has just like rolled with it, got up and kept on fighting. Does anything mean anything in this movie? Like, is there any amount of damage? Is there any amount of effect that means anything? Is there any amount of killing that means anything? I found it very draining. And I got to a point of thinking of it just as a very intellectual exercise in how do you make yet another combat sequence something that we haven't seen before on screen? So like the Arc de Triomphe sequence with all of the cars had a lot of like creative staging in it. And that was fun. And the sequences where he actually talks to people or at least is talked to by people, or the sequences where he's not on screen and Ian McShane is just being, you know, the coldest devil out there. I found all of that just so much more entertaining than some of the fight sequences here.
This movie, I enjoyed this as much as any of them since the first John Wick, and I think it has a tremendous closing speed, which is really makes up for a lot of the bloat. Like I really think a lot of the things I like, a lot of the stronger action sequences are reserved for the end of the movie. That's when it really kicks, and I think that's when it really needs to kick. I kind of did feel the bloat a little bit more towards the beginning. It felt a little bit more of the same, and you know that kind of tedium was setting in already with the second film, especially, and the third one I liked actually a little more than the second, but it was there too, and it seemed to be defying so much what it was when it started, which was kind of like, okay, it was so refreshing to see the original John Wick because it was like, okay, we're seeing a stunt person's movie. We're getting a real physical action, real visceral action, a very simple revenge plot that's not going to get too as soupy as it ends up getting as the mythology is sort of built up. And now, you know, we get to this movie and there's more CGI. It's got a lot of bloat. It's got a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things that it shouldn't work as well as it does, but it kind of does, you know, and I think the fact that it has some finality to it, you know, gives it a little bit of narrative juice that might have been missing from the middle two movies, which were just kind of like, okay, here's more of the same, and then it's going to lead to more of the same. At least this kind of had an end, and it has an excellent villain. I think Bill Skarsgård is tremendous fun, and I think a lot of the characters in the movie really again sort of pop. So this movie worked for me pretty damn well.
I mean, as you said, this was the motivation behind the first film was like, let's do this right. These are, you know, people who know stunts doing it right. Yeah, and I really appreciate that too. Like the sort of like, let's actually stage fight scenes where you can see the movement, you know, and that's something as simple as that made a big difference. But I feel like, you know, they've just gotten more stylistically ambitious since then. And there's some really just great images in this too. Like, it just, the, I was like, wow, you're really going for it with this as well. I don't remember, correct me if I'm wrong, but were the other ones as, I don't remember them being as steeped in movie references as this one, which includes, little homages from Lawrence of Arabia to the Warriors.
To a radio station called WUSIA.
Yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
Which features a never seen black woman who you're only looking at her mouth as she literally starts her show with like, "Hello, boppers." I mean, that's just, it's really, really literal in a way that I enjoyed. I know I don't remember the previous ones having quite so much movie homage, but honestly, past the first one, these movies haven't stuck with me a whole lot. Maybe mostly just because there's so much that doesn't matter, so much detail being piled up that in the end is just kind of irrelevant. I think it's really interesting in this one how much Keanu gets left out, like left behind, how much time this film spends away from him. And apart from the whole business with his family, it almost seems like it's not terribly interested in him and what's going on with him, even when it's with him, apart from the fight sequences. It's like this story has moved beyond him. It's much more about the world and the effect that he's having on the world than him himself. And when we're with him, he just seems tired and exasperated and ready for it to be over. And I don't mean that to sound like an accident or like I'm saying in a bad way. Like you might say, certain people have checked out of their roles. It seems like something that's just very much where the character has reached is a point of apathy and exhaustion. But what that means is whenever we see John Wick on screen and he isn't fighting, he's just like 1,000-yard stare, answering people's questions in monosyllables, being pushed around by other people's decisions. And it's an interesting place to have gotten with the guy whose name is literally the title of the movie.
Well, I think also it's funny how many people essentially ask him, like, do you know where this movie is going? like multiple people are like, have you thought about how this ends? Like, and I think, you do feel that the movie is acknowledging the fact that there is no clear out here aside from the one that it kind of ends on that feels inevitable. These movies are also haunted by death. But I think also, for all that this is like a sprawling multinational movie that involves, all of this mythology, it is also a movie where it's out of space. It's out of places to go. He can keep killing everyone, but as everyone assures him, that will never get him out of trouble. Like, there is no world in which he really escapes, this kind of alternate reality netherworld. There's just no way out. So there's nowhere to go, ultimately. And maybe that, for me, is where a bit of that bloat comes in, or like it feels like it's fed narratively, where you're just like, there is no kind of like strong sense of narrative propulsion guiding you through this movie. It just is kind of jumping from very cool set piece to very cool set piece in different countries.
I think that's why I like the end of it so much, because I think you could say that the moment where when the Marquis is like, he's not even going to make it to the duel, and we know that he has this space he needs to get to before sunset, that becomes the engine of the movie. That becomes kind of a mini movie in itself. It's thrilling because it's like, okay, now we have a direction, now we have something that's moving this movie forward, other than just like this free-floating, the revenge quest that never ends. Like, there's an end to this. Like if he gets to where he's going by the old rules, he's going to be able to have some sort of a satisfying duel. Though even that's a little bit confusing, because he has to fight Kane first, and I don't know. But so satisfying. Oh my God. The fact that everyone seems to realize in the audience and around him that Wick has not fired a bullet, except for the Marquis, who's just ready to roll. And man, that was exciting to see him get popped there.
There is a degree to which just getting to the duel, he's like already won. The movie has already climaxed in its way. And we kind of know how some of it is going to come out from there. Like, we don't necessarily have a sense of what the mechanics are going to be, but a lot, by the time he gets there, a lot of the decisions have been made. And there's a sense that the movie can slow down to the degree that it does at that point, you know, can get a little more contemplative and thoughtful, and can literally reduce one of its players to an audience member sitting by on the sidelines just waiting to see what happens, because the biggest action of the film has already taken place. He won just by getting to where he needed to be. He proved something and he won. And I like that dynamic of it. And I also liked the Mr. Nobody character a fair
yes,
bit.
Yeah.
Like an yeah. awful lot of the opponents, the bigger opponents that he faces throughout the course of this series stand out for a while and then disappear. I would have a hard time pointing you at many of them past Alfie Allen in the first movie. But this guy, like from the beginning, there was just something about him that stood out and that made me just start thinking, if part of the mechanics of this movie is like he's the second big bad on the way up to first Donnie Yen and then the Marquis, I'm going to be pretty tuned out of this movie. Like, I don't want to see this guy die. It has nothing to do with a dog. I'm not that sentimental about movie dogs, especially CG movie dogs. It's just that he has a personality and he has like desires and he has a way of expressing himself that's interesting. And I'm not sure what he's doing in this film except setting up a spinoff, because everything about his appearance and his edit in this movie says I'm getting the spinoff cut. But I still enjoyed him. Every moment he was on screen, I was just like, yeah, more of this guy. Let's see where this story's going.
It was really good to see Donnie Yen with such a big role in an American film as well.
Yeah, he's so fun in this movie. Mm-hmm. He's having such a good time. He's just kind of sassy, which I appreciate it for, you know, another character from this guy's past who's getting dragged out unwillingly. You know, him eating the noodles during that big Osaka set piece, it was delightful. Him, yeah, just seeming kind of like fed up of everything. He's, you know, he himself, like, you know, speaking of movie references, like he himself is like an homage, right? Like a living homage to a whole kind of history of Hong Kong action cinema. But he's so fun on screen here. And then, plenty to go back to Mr. Nobody for a second. Also, I enjoyed Mr. Nobody as well, but I did keep waiting for another beat. And I think the fact that there wasn't some kind of final cap to that story, yeah, also made me think about all of the spinoffs, which isn't something I love about, you know, like for all that this movie offers, at least an illusion of closure to this, you know, ever expanding story. It also offers an array of characters, all of whom seem like they are potential material, you know, to be followed in future TV series and spinoff movies, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that this is just how we make big movies now, for better and worse. Mostly
worse.
It's worse.
No, yeah. You're right. I hate thinking about movies that way. I'm just like, oh, this weird subplot exists because it's going to set something up later. Or be
right.
It's
like,
just...
why does it not go? And then you're like, oh, it's going because, like, yeah, later we're going to get a whole other movie. It's not going to get closed off in this movie.
And it's just, it's unfair to the character. It's unfair to the story arc that he seems to be telling. And it's unfair to the audience that they're drawn into this person's story, which this film isn't all that interested in. Ultimately, it's just interested in saying, well, you know, next time this guy will get his due next time.
Right. And it's, yeah, right. Like, you like this guy, right? We'll see.
It would have taken so little effort to give him a final beat, as opposed to just having him, like, I don't know, literally be forgotten off screen. It seemed like.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing, you know, I have really mixed feelings about the whole baroque world that John Wick has kind of developed on the fly as these movies have kept going on. In part because that first movie feels like a kind of never resolvable metaphor in some ways, maybe for to bring us back to the conversation from last time, a guy, you know, like it feels like a metaphor for work in some ways. It's a guy who is like, I'm done with the city life. I'm moving out to the burbs in New Jersey. I'm like, you know, this like terrible work-life balance I've had in the city. I'm getting rid of it. I'm going to have a better life out here, and then gets drawn back in. You know, I think a lot of, I don't mind the fact that I think it's impossible to really, the movies clearly keep making up more of these rules and institutions as they go along, because it mostly is an excuse for like very stylish, you know, settings and rituals. But I don't know that I feel all that excited about the idea that these movies have now at this point like served up this universe in which we're just like, now little stories can be set, you know? I kind of liked that you were seeing just little parts of what's supposed to be this like incredibly complex world just through John Wick's story. I don't know that I really want it to be fully built out, you know? I don't know that I think it makes sense to be fully built out. The more we see of it, the less it kind of comes together for me.
It's the ultimate in Mission Drift of just like, the first film was refreshing because it wasn't doing all that stuff. It wasn't like this world building exercise. It was just like this assassin was taking revenge for his dog and getting killed. It was like, it was so, you know, there was just a refreshing simplicity to it. There was a power to the action, the way it was staged, kind of an old school feeling to it. You know, it felt like you know, connected to the Hong Kong action films that were kind of surging in the, you know, in the early to mid 90s or something. And so when you add all of this world building and mythology and architecture, it feels well bloated, and also just like, oh, just like everything else. And you hate to see it, for sure.
Yeah, we don't need to see it that much. I think in this case, it works well enough.
It has to end. Like the fact that it ends is so important. Like it actually, that we get the end of John Wick, like that is, it, I think, extremely important to the film's success, is just having
I don't believe for a second in the end of John Wick. Everything about the way it's staged and shot and presented, I don't believe in it. I would like to think that this is a goodbye to this character, just because if we are going to continue this continuum ad infinitum, it would be nice to move on to a different story. Like the endless attempts to get out from under the table have become a little repetitive. So I'm ready for something else. I don't know what that is within this world where there do not seem to be any civilians whatsoever. The world is just made up entirely of assassins and people who employ assassins.
Well, I have some good news for you, Tasha, because filming right now, I believe, is a film called Ballerina, starring Ana de Armas, which is set within the John Wick universe. So that's something different, but also remaining the same, right?
I enjoyed Atomic Blonde. That was kind of, it's not in the Wick universe, but
it's
like
fun.
I thought that did what this sort of thing does quite well.
And Nobody, which was written by the writer the first three John Wick films, but not this one. I don't know what the story is there. But
you'd have to have something, a different title though, right? Isn't that the Odenkirk thing? Wasn't that Nobody? Nobody.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. Written by. I have a question for you, Scott, though.
Okay, hit me.
Who's on first? But anyway, you know who else that fooled? The Cyclops, when Odysseus said he was nobody. But that's a deep reference here to the Odyssey.
No, but I like it.
It's my second Homer reference this podcast. I'm kind of proud of myself.
Your classics major
now
is showing.
Well, once we start talking about Homer, maybe it's time to move on to the next part of this podcast, which is when we talk about this film in relation to Point Blank. We'll talk it over after the break.
You come here thinking there is a way out of this world for you, Mr. Wick. There is not. The Centre Pompidou.
Sacré-Cœur. Sacré-Cœur. Weapons.
If you win, the table will honor its word. You will have your freedom. but you won't take it. Blades.
Pistols.
Now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. What could these two films about killers on a quest for revenge possibly have in common? I guess one thing to start with is something that's kind of at the key at both of them is this kind of code of honor. We have Walker being horribly offended by the violation of this code, and we have a very elaborate code of honor in the John Wick films. What relation do they bear to each other?
Well, I think with Walker, I mean, it's almost as though he's trying to parse how his feelings of being his code of honor being violated fit in with, you know, this new world that maybe has moved on to something else. Mm-hmm. And I do think that maybe that fits together a bit with the John Wick world, which always implies that there was like a more civil time of assassins that, like, you know, is always being lost, right? The old ways. This is how we used to do things in the old times. And, you know, the, like, order is always threatening to be dissolved a bit, you know, maybe in part by John Wick running around and killing a bunch of people, you know, at the top of the chain. So certainly I think there's a bit there of a feeling of there are rules, but also maybe the world doesn't follow the rules as much as our hero has always assumed.
I think it's interesting that the implication is like we're all bound by the old rules and the old ways when people were somehow better, when everything was somehow classier. And yet in Point Blank, you've kind of got the idea of like, no, there are new rules now, and the new rules are better and more civilized and classier. And you're violating the new rules by behaving like an old school, old class guy. Just sort of a perspective difference, I think. In terms of like who's being most inconvenienced, I guess, by the behavior of the unstoppable revenge engine, the people who have changed things and like it in the new order, or the people who have had change foisted on them and don't like it in the new order.
I probably skip past the most obvious thing these have in common, which is they're two different revenge stories. We talked a little bit about where Point Blank fell on the scale of revenge films. You know, this is a different sort of revenge film with a much more, you know, elaborate and complicated type of revenge in some ways, even though it both eventually involve our heroes, quote unquote, firing their way through many, many throngs of opponents. I mean, are they fundamentally telling the same story?
Oh, I don't think so. I think the John Wick movies have, again, with the mission drift, like I think they left revenge movie behind a long time ago.
Okay.
You know, this isn't a movie about a guy trying to get to somebody who has done him personal harm anymore. It's about the organization. It's about the machine that he lives within. It's about trying to change the rules of the world that he lives in and just being told over and over and over, like, that's not how things work. Like, you're part of a system and you can't not be part of the system, until he points to a rule that says he could not be part of the system. And then everybody's like, oh, right. Yeah, that the thing that we all know about, but that nobody's ever brought up before.
Those rules seem like explicable to you, though, in these movies. I kind of don't get it. Like he's trying to kind of, he just wants peace, right? He wants to be out. And that's one thing that they won't, that is not allowed. But why? I mean, they eventually kind of invent something in this movie, which I guess gets coded as something as the old ways that is going to allow him to finally be free. But the route to get there before is so murky. And, you know, he does whatever he can anyway, and just it never gets the satisfaction that he wants.
Well, I mean, the way these movies are both the same story, and the way so many either revenge style stories or betraying our superstar and then he has to like kill his way back through the organization that betrayed him stories go. I guess that's just another form of revenge story. But, you know, movies like Hitman, like that kind of model also just follow this track very well. The thing that they all have in common is there is a very easy way to stop the mayhem and stop the bodies piling up, and that is to give the dude what he wants, which in both cases in these movies would be really pretty simple. take the price off John Wick's head and stop sending armies of goons to die. Give the man his $93,000, which you consider peanuts for your organization. It's not hard. But in both cases, you have these very prideful organizations and very proud men at the top of them that just can't admit defeat, that just can't back down. And you can say that that's because, you know, they would be setting a precedent, that they would be letting people know that there's a way to get to them. And maybe the honor among thieves would be broken. Maybe the rules would be broken. Maybe everybody would try this if one person got away with it. But in both cases here, you have one person just doing immeasurable harm because nobody can say, think about the end of THX 1138. Where the machine basically says, all right, we've reached the price tag for this particular disaster where it is not worth it anymore. Let's stop. Nobody in either of these movies is capable of doing that.
Tasha, this reminds me of another connection that I came up with that you had something very funny to say about. So I'm going to let you, I can find it here if you don't have it, but the connection was sort of like, why are men like this? And then what was your response to that? Do you have it at hand?
If you want to pull it up in Slack, be my guest. I would feel pretty silly reading my own gag out of Slack. But if it makes you happy, you can read it.
Tasha says, I tell you, a man will kill his way up the ladder of a shadowy criminal organization, ignoring all past emotional ties and even the fundamental linearity of time before he'll go to therapy. So I thought that was pretty good, Tasha.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that part of it was really something, because you know, to kind of continue these grudges, to continue this extraordinary violence over conflicts that seem easily resolvable and that would be just to resolve, I think it's just the nature of men in a way.
Yeah, I mean that's we should, you know, it's humorously phrased there, but these are men stories, and like you know, we John Wick's wife, we glimpsed very briefly here in flashback, but hasn't, you know, was gone before the first film even began. We lose Walker's wife fairly early on. These are in some ways are stories of what happens with, you know, when men become untethered from women.
I do think that one thing that revenge in both of these movies has in common is that it's really hard to know what these men really want. You know, throughout, we talked about how Walker in Point Blank is, you know, deliberately made a bit opaque in terms of, like, he wants this money, he says, even though people keep asking, like, what would you even do with this money? Like, do you really want this? And I think I will admit that, like, when John Wick 4 started, I was like, I have no recollection of, like, what he's trying to do at this point. Like, I don't know what he wants. You know, he turns to the camera and Lawrence Fishburne is like, are you ready, John? He's like, I'm ready.
No idea.
And I'm like, ready? What for what? Like, what are you doing at this point? I don't remember. And then he goes off and kills the elder, who is, you know, no longer played by Saeed Taghmoli. He's, like, played by a random person, presumably because they couldn't get the same actor. And kills him, and I'm just like, I don't even remember what that guy's deal is anymore. But I think at this point, it is difficult to kind of articulate, and kind of incidental maybe, to articulate like what John Wick's motivations are. You know, he says, I think, in the third movie, he wants to stay alive to, like, maintain the memory of his wife, like, which he feels maybe a little thin at this point for, as he places a trail of murdering, you know, hundreds of people throughout multiple continents. What about all their wives and the memories of their wives?
I think
by John Wick 4, for I think the idea of like what he wants has definitely gotten a little lost. It's a little lost in the sauce there, and maybe not that important.
Well, I find that really, really interesting, given how much all of y'all bagged on me for not seeing the righteousness of Walker wanting his $93,000 that was never his to begin with, that he was stealing off murdered men. Here, I mean, I find John Wick's desire to not be killed by assholes who will then win pretty relatable. I also would prefer not to be murdered by assholes. And then I would prefer for them to not, you know, dance on my grave. His desire to be the last man standing just so they don't win, it seems like a reasonable enough goal to me.
But he signed on to this. Like, he wanted this whole thing. Plus, the movie starts with him killing the, like, the elder, whatever the elder's deal is. Like, you know, like they could have just skipped that. If it was the whole movie was about him not wanting to be hunted and chased anymore, which is, I think, a very reasonable thing to want. But they specifically start the movie by dredging up, you know, this character so that he could ride in the desert on the horse and then find him. And so that character could offer a slightly tangled explanation for why he was no longer played by the same actor. and then die immediately. You know, like, I think there, like, the movie attempts to give, to make this a kind of active war, not just, you know, and I think, yeah, I do think a lot of it is just because this movie, maybe more so than the last two, for me, just felt like, it's the revenge plot, as much as it was there, is just kind of an excuse to get you from one place to another until the end, when you finally seem to, it's the movie knows where it's going.
So here's an idea. What if John Wick died in that original mugging, and like the past roughly decade or so has just been a really extended fantasy that he's been having, like as he's bleeding out on his floor next to his puppy? Like, is there a reading where it makes sense for all of this to just be a ghost? No, never mind. No,
it kind of actually, you know what, yeah, Tasha's
it kind of does.
It kind of tracks, actually.
Yeah, makes as much sense as anything. Maybe. Death Dream is just a universal reading you can give for almost every movie, actually.
I think, though, if they were revealed in John Wick 5 that it has been all a dream, I think there'd be a lot of upset viewers at that point.
Well, it's, John Wick 5 is actually just a movie about a guy living in New Jersey, having had like a prolonged hallucination.
Is that kind of what the last Matrix movie was, though? I mean, isn't it?
Exactly. It's a reverse Matrix, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, ugh. So, I mean, does he spend this movie just hanging out in New Jersey with his adorable, like, full-grown, at this point, 10-year-old beagle?
Exactly. And, you know, just running some errands, doing some lawn, you know, gardening.
Hanging out in New York City, passing.
Working on his car.
Passing,
yeah,
by
exactly.
This, like, really expensive looking hotel where everybody walking in and out seems to have gold coins for some weird reason. Then
it is very stylish. Absolutely. Yeah.
See, the problem with that reading, then, and the reason that it won't work within the John Wickiverse, is that would make him a civilian. And there are no civilians in John Wick movies. There are only assassins. Look, and people who hire assassins.
I mean, I think that I would love to talk about this for a moment, because I feel like, I feel like the movies sometimes verge on having some kind of internal logic for why, like, giant fights can happen on, say, you know, like, in the streets of Paris, or say in a nightclub in Berlin, and no one else who is there on scene seems to react to it. You know,
the nightclub was like, man, they are really unfazed by, they must be really,
yeah,
be like,
until the end. Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Everything in those nightclubs is so loud that it's really hard to notice something happening.
So they didn't notice, yeah.
And everybody's on acid or Molly, so, you know, they're going to be a little slow to respond. It is true that when I said there are no civilians in John Wick movies to my husband last night, I then immediately took it back because of the nightclub scene, which I had forgotten about. But yeah, it's sort of hard to read any of those people as human, given their reaction to everything going on around them.
They're completely blasted anyway. Yeah, it just reminded me of, like, something I kept thinking about Kendall's birthday party in Succession, when you're in every location of the, it's just like every locale in John Wick 4 is like a rich asshole's birthday party. It's kind of like sort of like the backdrop. But one thing we were talking about just a bit ago, which is the kind of another big connection, is this idea of death. I think these are both death haunted films. I mean, we talked about the potential of Walker as being this sort of supernatural figure, and if he's not supernatural, he's death haunted, and he doesn't, and there's really no future for him beyond achieving this quest that he feels he needs to achieve. There's no, you know, there's nothing he's going to do with the money. He's not interested in the money. He fades into, if he fades into the darkness, rather than actually going out and getting the money once it's presumably there. And then with John Wick, I think we've been on this mission for four films now, and that finally comes to an end where he's made his way through this gauntlet. He's, you know, achieved his freedom, and that freedom is death, and he can join his wife and his dog. So that's kind of a, I think, a pretty strong, you know, binding force with these two movies.
I can definitely see that. I mean, if you take Lee Marvin's fade back into the darkness at the end of Point Blank as him, you know, his spirit rejoining his body lying in a cell somewhere, or, you know, just the ghost fading out, it does have a nice little parallel. And these movies both kind of end with a, like, let's finally let this go, like a sense of resolution, basically from these two men having killed their way to the top.
There's just no one left to kill. All you can do is die at that point.
I think a thing that's maybe more of a line between them, though, is that most of the people in John Wick 4 that rise beyond the level of mook are pretty philosophical about the place that they've placed themselves in. Like, they have signed on for friendship with John Wick, and they know that means the destruction of everything they've built and their own death. Or they've signed on to be part of this organization, and they know that means they may be called on to kill friends or, you know, suffer the consequences, like lose their beloved families. There's just a lot of sort of a philosophical reckoning with death in the John Wick movies. And I think in this one more than any of the others, there's a sense that most of the major players don't necessarily want to kill or die, but they accept that this is the life that they signed on for and the contract that they signed. Whereas most of the people in Point Blank just seem exasperated and bewildered by this guy that's breaking all the rules. Pretty much what they signed on for was, retreats at a cozy mountain villa with a swimming pool that runs through the entire place. And they do not understand why they're having to deal with this, like, belligerent yelling guy instead.
Which is, that part is one of several touches that Soderbergh borrowed from The Limey, another film we've covered on this show. We've done a lot of revenge show movies on this podcast, haven't we?
Well, there are a lot of revenge movies out there.
Yeah, it's one of Genevieve's least favorite genres, and one of my favorites because I like a lot of violence, my beloved violence.
I'm not big on it myself, just because they tend to be kind of samey. And one of the things that at least enlivens both of these movies is that they try to mix it up, you know, by creating different kinds of worlds and different kinds of means of storytelling.
I mean, we try not to pick. Yeah, bad. At least with the classic films, at least we're trying to find, films of value, so we have that going for us as well. But I mean, there is something kind of like this crudely satisfying about, you know, I mean, it's a genre film, and if it's well executed, it can be very simple and satisfying. And of course, neither one of these films is simple, and they're satisfying in different ways.
In both of these movies, there is a sense that the massive criminal organization that these main characters get entangled with, that not only is there kind of no way away from them, but also no one seems to be really in charge of them. You know, it's something that really gets hammered in John Wick 4, that no matter what you do, you cannot kill like a final boss and then be done with the table, high table, right? Like, that everyone can be replaced, and that maybe everyone in this situation is like pretty unhappy in some way, but like there's no way out, you know, like that everyone has agreed to this this organization, and that like there's no fixing it. There's no repairing the system. It can only be as it is. But that was something that I found really interesting in the fourth movie, is just the sense that you cannot kill enough people that you can get out that way, because the organization is so big and so able to just fill it. No particular cog is irreplaceable. But yeah, it reminded me a bit of the organization in Point Blank, in that in Point Blank, you know, yeah, you can never seem to reach the guy who can actually do things. There's no one in charge.
Are you suggesting perhaps that you can climb to the top of the stairs, but once you get there, you're just going to fall right back to the bottom and have to do it all over again?
No, and then you got to get back up there. Maybe sometimes also you get the next shot of falling down more stairs. Oh, that
stuff is great.
Of course,
reminded me of that insane, what was it, TikTok talking about the myth of Sisyphus. Yeah. And then I saw another meme that said and someone saying Sisyphus has that dog in him. I just love that
rise
so
and
much.
Grind.
Oh my god, so cool.
All right, before we get too deep into TikTok lore and leave these two films behind, I gotta call out the fact that these are also just both movies about people that are really, really crappy to their underlings. Like, I have been just really, really conscious, I think since Blade, of the degree to which you can tell a decent classy villain by whether they treat their underlings with any kind of respect whatsoever. You know, the person that like goes and bounty hunts your enemy and that you then shoot instead of paying off is somebody that's not going to be able around to hunt down your next enemy. The person who works for you, who, you know, brings you important intel and then you get mad and cut off their arms is just a message to everybody to not tell you the truth anymore. And in both of these movies, you've got you've got the car salesman that like does his absolute best and also like shows himself to be bright and aware in meetings. And his reward is that he gets sent off to be sniped. You have somebody who shows exceptional promise at like tracking down the guy that nobody can keep track of who has killed 100 million of your people already. And your payment for him is to like diss him excessively, stab him in the hand, and refuse to give him his money that he's earned. Like, just treat your underlings right, people. Like, when you're on your way up in the ladder, you don't know who you're going to see when you're coming back down. So just pay off your criminal functionaries. You know, it's just not that hard.
Yeah, there's very little focus given to employee retention in these organizations.
John Wick 4 is really...
401k match. 401k match.
Right. It's really a labor story. That's what I want to... It's really a story about labor. Yeah, I think this is the spinoff I actually want to see of John Wick is just pick any one of the dudes who just gets just shot in the head and like just show us how he got to where it to that point in his life. So give us a rich family history, how he kind of joined the organization, what his relationship is with the people in charge, and then he just gets popped in the head.
That's basically a deleted scene on the first Austin Powers movie, if you check that out. It's actually really funny where they have a whole thing.
It's also my favorite gag in the movie Black Dynamite. Do you ever see Black Dynamite? There's a scene where he's training and the camera suddenly just focuses on one of the guys and he keeps beating up rather than Black Dynamite. And it's so funny because it just gets you that mindset of just like what happens if you're an underling in this situation. Like, oh, you're just your target practice. You're going to get popped in the head. You're going to get kicked and brutalized repeatedly in training sessions. It's those are the people I kind of want to get to know every once in a while.
I refuse to co-sign this call for yet another prequel.
I kind of want the admin person in the John Wick universe. I need, like, you know, the accountant or something. Give me like the person who is just trying to make sense of how the gold coins work. Why is it that one gold coin gets you like a drink? It's so hard to earn those gold coins.
One gold coin gets you a drink or an assassination.
So much money. I know. Really? Like, what is the currency exchange like? It's deeply confusing.
I couldn't, instead of giving somebody a gold coin and hiring them to go commit a murder, an entire ass murder for you, could you maybe give them a gold coin, ask them to go to the bar up the street and bring you back like five drinks?
Right. Yeah, are you allowed to have civilian drinks, or once you're in the slightly alternate assassin universe, you can only have assassin drinks?
Well, see, they all are very philosophical about paying a life every time they get an assassin drink, because this is the life that they've signed on for. They've agreed to this. Also, nobody wants to be the person that takes the coin and goes and gets the five civilian drinks, because nobody in this universe treats their underlings well. You come back with the five civilian drinks and you just get shot in the head.
They're gonna stab you. Yeah.
And probably take your gold coin back off of you. And then the three of you are going to say, oh, no, that was justified. It's okay to stab people and steal their money. And blah, blah, revenge, blah.
Yeah. Also, like, if you're a civilian, can you even use that gold coin for anything? Is it like Bitcoin? Is like the exchange rate very variable? Like, you know, how useful is it, honestly? You know, there's a lot of questions here. I think that could be addressed in an incredibly dry movie about a John Wick accountant just trying to balance an Excel spreadsheet or whatever the Assassin Universe version of Excel is.
While we're being very silly, can I also, while we're referencing the need for accountancy, can I just ask, I'm still very confused by this plot point in Point Blank. Mal steals the money from the money exchange and gives it to the criminal organization. And then later we see the criminal organization is doing that same money exchange. Did he just steal their money and give it back to them? Was it just like, hey, boss, tonight somebody murdered both of our bagmen and stole $93,000 for them? Coincidentally and unrelatedly, Mal Reese is here at the door with a bag with $93,000 in it that he owes us.
Pretty much, yeah.
I don't know. My husband is trying to convince me that the criminal organization that Walker's trying to fight his way through just saw that whole exchange at Alcatraz thing and thought it was a good idea. And they started doing it. But the original one was a completely different gang. I don't know. That just it's the same helicopter. You know, it's hard for me to buy.
It also, it just seems like a lot of bother to go all the way up to Alcatraz to do this. Like, is it really not a better spot?
It is pretty conspicuous, too. It's not your let's meet in a dark alleyway. It's like, let's go to this incredibly famous...
Right, like the whole city is there.
People love looking at Alcatraz, you know?
I think what's important is there's not a more cinematic spot.
It looks incredible. No, you got that's good filmmaking there when you just, like, forget it. We have to think about just how this looks visually. And just dispose of all the rest. And for that, I salute both Point Blank and John Wick 4.
Well, you can definitely say that for, the John Wick movie is very, very locale aware. And certainly having your gigantic face-off ultimate duel in front of a very, very prominent Parisian church atop a hill where everybody can see it, that's a decision. That's a power play. But both of these movies are very stylish. One of the places that I guess for me they lined up most is just the walk that Ian McShane does through, I assume that's the Louvre, to meet with the Marquis. That's just this long, long, long tracking shot of just a man walking with determination and purpose. We get just such a very similar shot in Point Blank of Lee Marvin is just walking through a space with the sound of his heels echoing. And in that case, we cut in and out of it to different things, to different flashbacks. But in both cases, here's just a shot of a man walking with purpose. And it's pretty mesmerizing.
I appreciated the humor of the Ian McShane scene as well. You know, like John Wick can be pretty serious as like a For as silly as the whole scenarios can be, it can be also pretty serious with regard to how it treats its world. So both the stairs and that like incredibly long scene of walking through an art gallery, they were delightful to me.
The John Wick movie is not unaware of humor, often a very dark humor. And then there's the pratfall humor, which is a completely different order of business and still very, very funny.
Yeah, the guy sitting next to me had at the film had some commentary he was interjecting, and he said this is like a cartoon. And I'm like, kind of. Like, I think it walks right up to that line. I mean, I think the series itself is kind of that way too, where it's aware that it's really of its own kind of ridiculousness, but it keeps just enough of a straight face to make it work. It's a balancing act, and I feel like the closest it came to tipping over is probably the cart, the pratfall down the stairs. But man, I love that so much.
So good. Yeah.
If you're sitting next to Keith at a movie, you always want to vocalize what you're thinking.
Oh yes, I encourage that. Times.
He loves it. He loves
very,
it.
Very into interjections from those sitting next to me, especially. But I'm less annoyed by it in a John Wick film than other sorts of films. So to be
movie
honest.
Theaters are loud now, which is nice.
That's true. They drown out all the extraneous conversation. Well, we were going to not have any more extraneous conversation on this particular topic. I hopefully didn't find all of it extraneous. Point Blank is currently available to rent through all the usual services. It's also on DVD and Blu-ray and has some pretty neat stuff. Like, you know, I always think if you can, an audio commentary is good, but an audio commentary where Steven Soderbergh is helping you out, that's the gold standard right there. The film John Wick Chapter 4 is in theaters nationwide. Finally, it's time to recommend a film or film-related item that complements this set of episodes. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put something interesting on your radar. I'm going to take this one because I really do want to talk about one of my favorite incarnations of Parker, which is the comic book artist and writer Darwin Cook embarked on a series of adaptations of the Richard Stark, you know, Donald Westlake Parker novels, and they are remarkable. Cook if you've seen his stuff, you'll know it instantly. It's kind of inspired by the illustrative style of the 1950s or 1960s, but also by animation. He kind of got one of his big, you know, entryways into it was working on some of the Batman animated series shows. He's remarkable. I love his stuff. He's one of my favorite artists. I have original Darwin Cook art on my wall. Unfortunately, he died in 2016 at the too young age of 53, and only was able to do the first four Parker books and the novella, The Man with the Getaway Face. They're all wonderful, and they're from IDW Publishing, and they have that kind of same, like, economy, you know, the economy of his art really matches the economy of Westlake's prose. It's a really great merger of sensibilities. And you know, Westlake died shortly, I believe, before the first book came out, but the two of them were able to talk about it before. And like, you got Westlake's blessing and input on some of this. They're all, you know, I can't really speak highly enough of them. If you really want to splurge, there's this nice hardcover editions that are kind of oversized that compile a few of them with a lot of bonus material, including all, you know, artistic renditions of all the actors who have played Parker over the years in the Darwin Cook style. But the other, you know, they're also available individually, you know, at affordable prices. And like I said, if you're intrigued at all by, if you enjoyed Point Blank and if you enjoy Westlake's writing, I really could not do better than to seek these out. Tasha, you're a comics reader, I know. Have you read any of these?
I am a comics reader, but I've never read any of the Parker books in any form. And I'm definitely going to look these up because I'm certainly curious.
Yeah, I need to read more of the actual novels. I've only read The Hunter, which is really quite, it is like, you know, as someone who's read, you know, plenty of James Ellroy and such over the years, it is scarily hard boiled. Like, it's just a mean writing. And I've read some of Westlake's other books and they're fun. They're has a really light touch. It really was, you know, it did seem to be channeling two different sides of the same authorial personality with his writing. Well, that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show, but we'll be back next week with another set of episodes. Tasha, do you want to tell us about our episodes dropping on April 4th and April 11th?
Currently playing on Hulu after its Sundance debut, Rye Lane, the first feature film from English director Rainn Alan Miller, stars Vivian Opara and David Johnson as, respectively, Yas and Dom, a pair of 20-somethings who meet and unexpectedly wind up spending the day together. Over the course of a long ramble through the South London neighborhood that gives the film its title, they get to know each other and find they have a lot in common as they inch toward a romantic connection. As we were thinking of films that might have inspired Rye Lane, it only took a small leap to arrive at Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise, in which Ethan Hawke and Julia Delpy meet and fall for each other as the result of a lot of walking and talking. We look forward to taking these two parallel journeys with you in our next episodes.
For now, we welcome your feedback on Point Blank and John Wick Chapter 4 and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. You can email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. Before we close out this week's episode, where can you find everyone these days? Allison, we'll start with you as our special guest.
Well, you can find my writing at Vulture, find my byline there. It'll all be there. And you can find me on Twitter at Allison Wilmore, though I've been trying to be on there less for my own sake.
What about your dog? Does your dog have any sort of social media presence?
Yeah, you can find my dog on Instagram. It's Sammo the dog, Sammo, S-A-M-M-O. And, you know, his adventures are much more exciting than mine.
Highly recommended. I love that page.
How about you, Scott?
You can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. I'm a sicko. I still participate quite heavily at Twitter. You can find my work chiefly at The Reveal, the newsletter that I write with Keith. It's thereveal.substack.com. You can also find my work in the New York Times, in Guardian, in Vulture, and other fine publications. Tasha?
I am the film and streaming editor at Polygon.com. You can find me writing about film and TV and occasionally books and comic books there. I am on Twitter-ish at Tasha Robinson. Keith?
I'm a freelance writer. You can find my writing. I'm on Twitter at KFIP3000. You can find my writing at places like GQ, The Ringer, TV Guide, and Vulture. And also, as Scott mentioned, The Reveal, which is a newsletter that he and I write that there's a lot of heart in that newsletter, wouldn't you say? A lot of heart?
I think so. Yeah. So blood, the Reveal, sweat, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's thereveal.substack.com. Our absent co-host, Genevieve Kosky, can be found on Twitter occasionally at Genevieve Kosky, and she is the senior TV editor at Vulture. And as for the podcast as a whole, you can stay updated on the Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at Next Picture Pod. You can get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your rating and reviews on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Baked Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.